Chapter 84. My reception aboard. It was the middle of a bright tropical afternoon that we made good our escape from the bay. The vessel we sought lay with her main topsail aback about a league from the land, and was the only object that broke the broad expanse of the ocean. On approaching, she turned out to be a small slatternly-looking craft, her hull and spars a dingy black, rigging all slack and bleach nearly white, and everything denoting an ill state of affairs aboard. The four boats hanging from her sides proclaimed her a whaler. Leaning carelessly over the bulwarks were the sailors, wild, haggard-looking fellows in Scotch caps and faded blue frocks, some of them with cheeks of a mottled bronze, to which sickness soon changes the rich berry brown of a seaman's complexion in the tropics. On the quarter deck was one whom I took for the chief mate. He wore a broad-brimmed Panama hat, and his spyglass was leveled as we advanced. When we came alongside, a low cry ran fore and aft the deck, and everybody gazed at us with inquiring eyes. And well they might. To say nothing of the savage boat's crew, panting with excitement, all gesture and vociferation, my own appearance was calculated to excite curiosity. A robe of the native cloth was thrown over my shoulders, my hair and beard were uncut, and I betrayed other evidences of my recent adventure. Immediately on gaining the deck, they beset me on all sides with questions, the half of which I could not answer, so incessantly were they put. As an instance of the curious coincidences which often befall the sailor, I must here mention that two countenances before me were familiar. One was that of an old man of war's man, whose acquaintance I had made in Rio de Janeiro, at which place touched the ship in which I sailed from home. The other was a young man whom, 4 years previous, I had frequently met in a sailor boarding house in Liverpool. I remembered parting with him at Prince's Dock Gates, in the midst of a swarm of police officers, trackmen, stevedores, beggars, and the like. And here we were again. Years had rolled by, many a league of ocean had been traversed, and we were thrown together under circumstances which almost made me doubt my own existence. But a few moments past ere I was sent for into the cabin by the captain. He was quite a young man, pale and slender, more like a sickly counting house clerk than a bluff sea captain. Bidding me be seated, he ordered the steward to hand me a glass of pisco. In the state I was, this stimulus almost made me delirious, so that of all I then went on to relate concerning my residence on the island I can scarcely remember a word. After this I was asked whether I desired to ship. Of course I said yes, that is, if he would allow me to enter for one cruise, engaging to discharge me, if I so desired, at the next port. In this way men are frequently shipped on board whalemen in the South Seas. My stipulation was acceded to, and the ship's articles handed me to sign. The mate was now called below, and charged to make a L-man of me. Not, let it be borne in mind, that the captain felt any great compassion for me, he only desired to have the benefit of my services, as soon as possible. Helping me on deck, the mate stretched me out on the windlass and commenced examining my limb, and then doctoring it after a fashion with something from the medicine chest, rolled it up in a piece of an old sail, making so big a bundle that, with my feet resting on the windlass, I might have been taken for a sailor with the gout. While this was going on, someone removing my tappa cloak slipped on a blue frock in its place, and another, actuated by the same desire, to make a civilized mortal of me, flourished about my head a great pair lie imminent jeopardy of both ears, and the certain destruction of hair and beard. The day was now drawing to a close, and, as the land faded from my sight, I was all alive to the change in my condition. But how far short of our expectations, is oftentimes the fulfillment of the most ardent hopes. Safe aboard of a ship so long my earnest prayer with home, and friends once more in prospect, I nevertheless felt weighed down by a melancholy, that could not be shaken off. It was the thought of never more seeing those who, notwithstanding their desire to retain me a captive, had, upon the whole, treated me so kindly. I was leaving them forever. So unforeseen and sudden had been my escape, so excited had I been through it all, and so great the contrast between the luxurious repose of the valley, and the wild noise and motion of a ship at sea, that at times my recent adventures had all the strangeness of a dream, and I could scarcely believe that the same sun now setting over a waste of waters, had that very morning risen above the mountains, and peered in upon me as I lay on my mat in Taipei. Going below into the forecastle just after dark, I was inducted into a wretched, hunger sleeping box built over another. The rickety bottoms of both were spread with several pieces of a blanket. A battered tin can was then handed me, containing about half a pint of tea so called by courtesy, though whether the juice of such stalks as one finds floating there deserves that title, is a matter all shipowners must settle with their consciences. A cube of salt beef, on a hard round biscuit by way of platter, was also handed up, and without more ado, I made a meal, the salt flavor of which, after the Nebuchadnezzar fare of the valley, was positively delicious. While thus engaged, an old sailor on a chest just under me was puffing out volumes of tobacco smoke. My supper finished, he brushed the stem of his sooty pipe against the sleeve of his frock, and politely waved it toward me. The attention was sailor-like. As for the nicety of the thing, no man who has lived in forecastles is at all fastidious. And so, after a few vigorous whiffs to induce repose, I turned over, and tried my best to forget myself. But in vain. My crib, instead of extending fore and aft, as it should have done, was placed athwartships, that is, at right angles to the keel, and the vessel, going before the wind, rolled to such a degree, that every time my heels went up and my head went down, I thought I was on the point of turning a somerset. Besides this, there were still more annoying causes of inquietude. And every once in a while a splash of water came down the open scuttle, and flung the spray in my face. At last, after a sleepless night, broken twice by the merciless call of the watch, a peep of daylight struggled into view from above, and someone came below. It was my old friend with the pipe. "Here, shipmate," said I, "help me out of this place, and let me go on deck." "Halloa, who's that croaking?" was the rejoinder, as he peered into the obscurity where I lay. "Eh, Taipei, my king of the cannibals, is it you? I say, my lad, how's that spar of yarn? The mate says it's in a devil of a way, and last night set the steward to sharpening the handsaw. Hope he won't have the carving of ye." Long before daylight we arrived off the Bay of Nukuheva, and making short tacks until morning, we then ran in, and sent a boat ashore with the natives who had brought me to the ship. Upon its return, we made sail again, and stood off from the land. There was a fine breeze, and notwithstanding my bad night's rest, the cool fresh air of a morning at sea was so bracing, that, as soon as I breathed it, my spirits rose at once. Seated upon the windlass the greater portion of the day, and chatting freely with the men, I learned the history of the voyage thus far, and everything respecting the ship and its present condition. These matters I will now throw together in the next chapter. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.